Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to Heartwind's Building Sustainability podcast. I'm Geoffrey Hart, and this is episode number 2. Before I talk about this episode's guest, I just want to tell you about our 2019 student application process. We are building 2 straw bale workshops from foundations right the way through framing, insulation, putting the roof on, doing everything. You can come along and be part of that. And it's free. You will receive a complete build education with classroom sessions to talk about theory, but mostly you'll be just getting hands-on and learning by doing. So if that sounds like something you'd like to do, head on over to the Heartwind website, read the information on there, tell you all the dates and what it's going to build, some pictures of what the thing looks like, and there's also the application form, so get that filled in and we can't wait to read all about you. So this episode's guest is Chris Vernon. Chris was a climate scientist, realized that there was enough climate scientists saying this is what you need to do and not really enough people doing it. So he and his wife Erica and their family have moved to Wales to build a new small holding under Wales's One Planet development policy. I'll let Chris tell you more about that and what it all entails in the episode. But in a nutshell, it's living sustainably off the land, living in a carbon neutral, beautiful straw bale house. So Chris will tell us a little bit about what the One Planet development policy is and how it applies. And then we will talk through a little bit about his straw bale house. So big thanks to Chris for coming on the podcast, and big thanks for you for listening. That's cheesy.
We're currently in our house that is not quite finished, but we're nearly there. It's our self-built house on our One Planet development in Carmarthenshire in Wales. We've spent the last 2 years or so building this house, and it's at the stage where the two of us can sit down and have a relaxed conversation in it. The sun is shining and the house is working.
Yeah, it's lovely and warm on this reasonable day. Well, actually, for March, it's pretty glorious. So I think we'll come back to One Planet development and what that is and what it means. But I'm interested to know about your background and what's led you to this point.
Yeah, so this point is myself and my wife and children living in a rural setting, basically a small holding in southwest Wales. But we didn't always live like this. Whilst I did grow up on a small holding in a different part of the country, for the last 20 years or so, I've been after university, working in engineering, and most recently at the Met Office, looking at climate change, amongst other things. But a few years ago, I think we came to the conclusion, my wife and I, she's also a climate scientist, that climate science and the study of it, the academic side of researching the situation we find ourselves in, really, it wasn't really delivering the results that we'd like. It wasn't really enabling the change that we'd like to see in the world. It wasn't really addressing the problem. The climate science community is very good at understanding the situation, proposing changes that may improve the situation, but hasn't been particularly successful in delivering those changes,
right?
Or maybe communicating the changes in an effective enough way such that politicians and the general public can get on board with delivering those changes.
Right.
So a few years ago, I think I decided, not long after completing my PhD, that rather than spend the next 10 or 20 years in academia studying the situation we find ourselves in and possibly writing and publishing academic papers, I'd rather take a sort of one step outside of that and actually try and live my life and try and do something practical that was aligned with my understanding of the situation, aligned with the science. So I was looking for a way to reduce my consumption, reduce my environmental impact. And that started really with where we lived and the house we lived in.
Where were you living at that point?
I was living down in Exeter. In a fairly conventional house. Before that, Bristol, again, in a fairly conventional house. Long-term series of renting lots of different houses, and the rental market is maybe a topic for another day. Trials and tribulations of renting in the UK. We wanted the security of owning our own house, but houses are rather expensive, and whilst we probably could have afforded to buy a house, it would have entailed several decades of mortgage and both of us working most of the hours. And with a young family, we didn't really want to lock ourselves into that situation of having sort of decades worth of mortgage to pay off. So we were looking at, well, what are the alternatives? Are we able to self-build? And it turns out that we are able to self-build with a whole host of advantages that can bring.
Right. And so now we're talking about the One Planet development now, aren't we? It's actually quite difficult to self-build affordably, I would say, in the UK, because any plot that has building permission is vastly inflated in price, and anything without is you're gambling a huge amount if you can actually get planning.
That's definitely the case. The planning system in the UK has had a very abrupt cut off in that either land has planning permission to live on, in which case developers build as many houses as they can, and you have small houses with small gardens to maximize the return for the developer, or you have open countryside with no houses on it.
Yeah.
So the concept of creating a new house with a parcel of land attached to it, basically a small holding, just doesn't really exist in the planning system. So there are thousands of small holdings in the UK, but there are very, very few small holdings that have been built since the 50s,
right,
since the sort of existing framework of planning legislation came into force. Now, if you regard small holdings as a sensible way of developing, which I do. I think small holdings give a degree of resilience to a household. They enable a household to have a low environmental impact. Mm-hmm. There's also a degree of responsible land stewardship that's possible with small holdings.
Yeah.
Small holdings are very good for biodiversity. They're very complex environments, rather than sort of dense urban environments which don't have a lot of space for biodiversity, and monoculture, industrial agriculture in the countryside, which again doesn't have very much space for biodiversity. So I think small holdings are a nice way for humans to interact with the earth system.
Yeah.
But the planning system doesn't recognize that. The planning system basically doesn't make it possible for the creation of new small holdings in the UK. There are a few sort of bits of policy that blur the edges a bit. But here in Wales, we have the One Planet Development Policy, which specifically allows the creation of new small holdings or new small farms in the open countryside. So you're able to build a house in the open countryside, mm-hmm. which typically isn't possible under planning policy. But there are a number of requirements to ensure that that remains a sensible decision. Firstly, talking about the building itself needs to be zero carbon in construction and use. So no fossil fuels used in its sort of operation. You're not allowed to be using coal or oil or gas or grid electricity, which is generated from gas in part. And in construction, zero carbon in construction is rather poorly defined, but the way most people interpret it is that the amount of carbon sequestered in the fabric of the building should offset the amount of carbon that was emitted in the high carbon elements of the building. Uh-huh. So glass, for example, is obviously an element of a building which is unavoidable, but does have a carbon footprint associated with it.
So you're talking about there things like trees or straw where they've grown there out in their field, and they are carbon, and you're using those as a building material. So by sequestering them, you're essentially stopping them breaking down.
That's exactly it. So when the tree grows, it absorbs carbon from the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. If the tree were to die and decompose naturally, that carbon would return to the atmosphere. If it were to be cut down and burnt as firewood or chipped and burnt in a power station, or if it was chipped and then the chips were put on the ground to compost, that all releases the carbon again. So the tree dies, and within a year or two or three, depending on how it was used, the carbon that it absorbed during its lifetime will be back in the atmosphere. The timber we've used in our house, and we've used quite a lot of it because it's got a fairly significant roundwood timber frame. It's a two-story house, and also all the joists and rafters are locally sourced timber as well. That carbon that's in the timber will be sequestered, kept out of the atmosphere for at least the age of this house, which could be hopefully in excess of 100 years. But even if this house were to fall down, a lot of the timbers would be recovered and used in a subsequent building. So by capturing this timber and using it in construction in the way we have, we've kept that carbon out of the atmosphere for many centuries. We anticipate so that could be seen as sequestered carbon, which when you run the numbers has offset the amount of carbon involved in the manufacturing of the glass and the manufacturing of the copper in our electrical wires and that sort of thing.
So you're trading the two off against each other.
And it's not just the timber. We've also used straw bale in the walls. We've used almost 500 straw bales in the wall. So that's again represents a few tons of carbon, which is locked up for, instead of 1 year, which it would have been if a straw had been burnt or if it had been used as bedding or even ploughed back into the field. That straw is now being held, that carbon is now being held back from the atmosphere for the lifetime of the house, which given where we are with carbon emissions and the amount of carbon in the atmosphere, I'd argue that sort of any little helps keeping carbon out of the atmosphere right now is a positive. So not only is there that positive that we've kept carbon out, but by using the straw and the timber instead of using bricks and cement to build the house, we've kind of win twice in a way. We've captured carbon from the atmosphere and kept it there, but also we've mitigated the use of the alternative, which would have been the bricks and the cement.
Yeah.
So it's sort of, it's depends on how you run the numbers and things, but generally we're confident that us choosing to live in this house and create this house has had a lower impact than if we'd chosen to have a conventionally built house built for us or live in an existing house, but require someone else to live in a new house, if you know what I mean.
Sure. And it would, is there a possibility of a net gain in, have you actually done the numbers?
We haven't done the numbers to that degree of certainty that there's a possibility of a net gain. There may be. I wouldn't like to pin my flags to that mark exactly, but yeah, it's going to be of that order.
Excellent. So that's one of the elements of one.
Yes. Yeah, so the One Planet Development Policy, so that's the buildings themselves. Mm-hmm. There's also a requirement to meet your minimum needs from the site itself.
Okay.
Now, this isn't the same as being self-sufficient. I'd argue being self-sufficient is basically impossible in a Western country in today's world. But the planning policy quite specifically defines your minimum needs.
Mm-hmm.
And your minimum needs are your energy, your waste assimilation, the stuff that can be composted. There's also some financial minimum needs, such as paying your council tax, paying your transport costs, paying for your clothing, paying for your IT and telecommunications. Council deems as a minimum need these days. And a fraction of your own food. So we need to make about 2/3 of our own food from site.
Right.
But the food itself is a little bit awkward. Whilst the site has to provide 2/3 by value of our food, only about 1/3 of that has to be directly grown on site.
Yeah.
And the other third, approximately, can be bought, but with income that's derived from activities on site.
Right. So when you're saying about the council tax, that's the same.
Exactly. So yes. The council tax is required to be paid for in currency. So the planning policy requires a land-based enterprise, basically a small business, to run from the site, which earns enough money every year to pay for your council tax, to pay for your IT and telecommunications, to pay for your transport expenditure, pay for your clothing.
Yeah.
So it's not the sole income. It's not all the money that the household requires, but the land-based enterprise, the site, has to supply the minimum needs.
Right.
And for us and for typical One Planet developments, it's a few thousand pounds, maybe £5,000 a year.
Okay.
So our...
Seems like a reasonable amount.
Yeah. So our land-based activities here on the site have to earn around £5,000 a year that cover off those minimum needs as the policy describes them.
Mm-hmm. And what are people doing? Well, what are you doing to meet those needs?
So there's a huge variety of how people earn their money off their sites. In our case, we sell honey. We keep bees. We have around a dozen colonies of bees. Mm-hmm. At the moment, we just sell honey, though we are thinking about selling bees themselves, colonies of bees in the spring.
How much does the average colony of bees go for? That's something I've never heard of.
Well, it depends on the size of a colony and the time of year. A small colony, a nucleus colony, a nuke, which has overwintered, so it would be ready for sale in the spring, would be over £100.
Really?
And a full production colony a little bit later in the season might be even closer to £200, maybe about £150. So producing colonies of bees for sale is a viable enterprise.
I interrupted you. You were saying your
So that's sort of one strand of our enterprise is the beekeeping business. And the other strand of our enterprise is an apple orchard.
Right.
When we first bought this land, we grafted and planted about 2 acres of apple orchard, about just over 200 trees. Mm-hmm. And they are just sort of coming into production now, sort of best part of 5 years on now.
Right.
So that will produce apples, which we will mainly juice and sell the apple juice. So our main products from the site are honey and apple juice.
Right.
But other One Planet developments have quite a wide range of different products. Anything from meat to flowers to eggs to sort of willow work and woodwork. A land-based enterprise doesn't necessarily have to be horticulture, obviously.
Right.
It can be anything which has a land-based component. So so if you're growing timber and then carving spoons from the timber that you've grown on the site, that spoon is a land-based product.
Gotcha.
Because the timber that has gone into it is land-based.
Is it your land-based rather than land-based?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. So the One Planet development planning policy refers to the bit of land on which your One Planet development is based. It's where your house is, where your infrastructure is, and the products that are grown or reared on site have to come from that bit of land. So you're managing this bit of land in a way that can support your minimum needs.
Correct.
So we've discussed the building and we've discussed the need for the site to meet your minimum needs. Another aspect of the policy is the ecological footprint. Now, the ecological footprint is a measure of impact or a measure of consumption. It's related to your behavior.
Right.
And it's where the name of the policy comes from, the One Planet development. So the One Planet in that refers to having an ecological footprint of one planet. And what that means is if everybody had an ecological footprint of one planet, then we as a global population would be sustainably using the Earth's resources.
As in, we would need one planet.
We would need one planet to support us.
Right.
So our consumption of food and of raw materials, but also our production of waste and the assimilation of that waste into the Earth system would be basically in balance.
Okay.
So the Earth could support our common population if we all had ecological footprints of one planet.
Yeah.
Because there'd be enough plants growing, there'd be enough crops, there'd be enough fish growing, and there'd be enough waste assimilation in terms of our own waste, our pollution, and the whole system would be in balance.
Gotcha.
Now, globally, we're not in balance at the moment as a population. We're using maybe 1.5, 1.7 planets.
Globally.
Now, in the rich West, we're using even more than that. So in Wales, we're using a bit more than 3 planets globally. So individually, the average person in Wales is using about 3 times more of the Earth's production and the Earth's waste assimilation capacity in our average lifestyle here in Wales. But those people living on One Planet developments have moderated their behavior, moderated their consumption, such that our impact is down to the One Planet level.
Yeah.
So we're not making excess demands on the planet.
Uh-huh. I think I heard that if we all lived, was it like they're living in Dubai, it was something like 8 planets or something like that, that we'd need to sustain.
Yeah, there's a broad spectrum. I mean, fundamentally, it comes down to how wealthy you are and how much you spend.
Right.
Because it's consumption based. Uh-huh. And if you're very wealthy and if you spend a lot, then pretty much by definition, you've got a high consumption and a high ecological impact.
Right.
And if you're very poor and you spend very little, then you have a very low ecological impact. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty much impossible to have a very large ecological impact if you haven't got any money.
Right. Well, that's good to know.
But if you're very wealthy and you buy a lot of things and you buy a lot of energy and you travel around a lot,
yeah,
then you've, by definition, pretty much got a high ecological footprint.
Uh-huh. So one planet in general, what's the uptake of that so far?
The one planet development planning policy that's available in Wales has been available for about a decade now. It was 2009, I think, that the policy was published.
Yeah.
The take up was quite slow in the early years. But following the publication of the practice guidance, mm-hmm. which was a much more significant document published by the Welsh government that explained the policy in more detail than uh-huh. had previously been available, really helped applicants understand the policy,
yeah.
but also helped the local authority and planning officers to understand the policy.
Yeah,
and I think there are approximately 30 or so One Planet developments in Wales now.
So that's quite a slow uptake in 10 years then.
Yeah, there's approximately 30, but I'd say more than half of those have occurred in the last maybe 2 or 3 years.
Right.
So there's definitely
the beginning of
there's definitely an acceleration.
Yeah.
There aren't One Planet developments in all parts of Wales yet. I think approximately half of the local authorities have OPDs.
Yeah.
OPDs, One Planet developments. There's a bit of a concentration in the southwest of Wales, Pembrokeshire, Carmarthenshire, Ceredigion. A little bit sort of historical there's always been an interest in low impact development in this part of Wales. But in recent years, there have been OPDs in Mid Wales and in North Wales as well.
Paris just got their first one, didn't they?
Yes, I think there's two in Paris.
Oh, two now.
Possibly, and I think there's another one maybe in the pipeline. So it is a national policy,
yeah.
and there are applications and approvals occurring throughout Wales now.
Do you know what sort of numbers are putting in applications? What the next few years might hold for?
There are quite a few applications I'm aware of that are in the pipeline. The approval rate is actually very high. Mm-hmm. Very few OPD applications are actually rejected.
Right.
And it was quite a lot involved in producing a One Planet development application. It's a planning application for a new house, just like any other.
Yeah.
But you also have to explain what your land management plan is going to be.
Yeah.
What are you going to do on this site? Which is going to facilitate your low ecological footprint? Which is going to facilitate the meeting of your minimum needs?
Yeah.
And you have to show other improvements. You have to show biodiversity improvements. You have to show sort of public social improvements. There's a lot of evidence that's required. There's a lot of planning and structure that goes into it. Typical OPD applications run well north of 100 pages
right.
of text, Crikey. Of evidence, of plan. There's often a permaculture design ethos that runs through a One Planet development.
Yeah.
Because it's so design heavy, and permaculture provides a very nice design framework in which to develop land.
So tell me a little bit about what's happening on this site here, because it's not your standard One Planet development.
So almost all One Planet developments, in fact, all One Planet developments, except for ours, are single household developments. There are some OPDs have neighbouring OPDs quite close to them. Mm-hmm. And in Pembrokeshire, there is the Lammas Eco Village, which is not a One Planet development, but falls under a very similar planning policy that was available in Pembrokeshire only a few years back when the Lammas Eco Village was formed. But within the One Planet development policy framework.
Yeah.
Our site here in Carmarthenshire is the only multi-unit development. So we have four houses here that operate independently. We have four separate freeholds,
yeah.
But we are close neighbours,
right,
with a degree of organic bespoke cooperation.
Mm-hmm.
So there's not very much organized structure, organized fun, or commitments to one another.
Right.
We're not that kind of community, but there is this sort of organic relationship of having friendly, helpful neighbors.
Sure.
Which we think strikes a very nice balance between being isolated and being in a close-knit community with all of the sort of political and social pitfalls, yes, that so often arise in communities.
Of some communities.
Yeah. So we so far, touch wood, we think we've struck quite a nice balance,
yeah,
between having some of the benefits of having close, cooperative, friendly neighbours without some of the pitfalls that so often befall organised, intentional communities. But the history of the site, we bought the land in 2013, early 2013.
And how big is the piece of land?
The site is 21 acres, and it's quite a diverse bit of land. It's on a gentle west-facing slope,
right,
with a significant amount of road frontage and also the little stream at the bottom. Mm. There's maybe 3-4 acres of mature deciduous woodland, some flat areas, some slopes. So it's quite a nice bit of land in that respect. It's often the case that land is all pasture,
right,
or it's all woodland,
mm-hmm,
neither of which are ideal for one planet development. The diversity is really quite a nice thing to look for,
yeah,
in a bit of land. So we split the 21 acre site up into our four separate small holdings,
uh-huh,
essentially, and applied for planning permission for four separate one planet developments.
So you each own a parcel of what, sort of 5 acres?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So we each have our own independent 5 acres, which we manage ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
The planning process took a little while. We were the first one planet development in Carmarthenshire, and it took a little while for the local authority to get up to speed with the policy.
Right.
And we changed planning officers twice, so completely unrelated, but we went through a couple of different planning officers, which entailed a little bit of delay. But but the application was recommended for approval by our planning officer.
Right.
But ultimately the planning committee rejected it on a split vote.
Okay.
We didn't feel they really understood the policy. Mm-hmm. As I say, it was the first time that the planning committee had seen an application under this,
yeah,
relatively new policy at the time.
So the committee that approves it or denies it are not the same as the planner.
No, the way planning works is the council employs planning officers,
mm-hmm,
who are professionally trained in planning, have a degree in planning typically, and they have a good detailed understanding of planning policy,
mm-hmm,
but any decision which is a little bit contentious tends to go to the planning committee,
right,
which is made up of councillors who, okay, have an interest in planning, but they aren't necessarily technically trained,
sure,
in, yeah, planning the same way a planning officer is. So when our application, which is a very unusual application, and involved a new bit of planning policy, the planning committee were not totally up to speed with it.
Right.
And ended up deciding against us. Mm-hmm. But we appealed that decision. So the decision went to the planning inspector, and the planning inspector is a planning professional, full-time planning inspector at the Welsh national level. And that's a fresh look at the application.
Sure, yeah.
And at that point, the planning committee's refusal was overturned and the inspector granted us permission and awarded us our costs as well, because the decision had been made incorrectly the right. first time around. So we received our permission in July 2016. And that's when the development really started. Then that's when the work started. That's when we started thinking about the sort of details, specifics of the design. Mm-hmm. And we were able to move on to the site then. I mean, we personally didn't move on to the site. What with having small children and the pitfalls of living in caravans and things. but the project here with the four households started in summer 2016.
Okay. And what's the sort of background of the other people here? Did you, like, were you a close-knit group before you moved here, or how do you find people to live in a place like this doing this?
Of the four households that are here, we only knew one of the other households initially. But when we put the word out that they were looking for another two households to join us, very quickly people emerged and were recommended to us or became known to us. I can't remember exactly the details. Uh-huh. But no, it was not. We weren't a community beforehand, but it was not hard to find people to come and join us.
Sure.
So after we were granted permission in summer of 2016, it took us a few months to put everything in place to start the build.
Right.
We needed to use predominantly local natural materials, uh-huh. and that drove us down the timber and straw route, as we discussed earlier.
Yeah.
There are two different ways of building with straw, really. You can do what's called a load-bearing straw bale build, where the walls are made of the straw bales and the roof is sitting directly on those straw bales. So the straw bales are a structural element of the building. And the other way of doing it is to involve some other structure, typically a timber frame. And it's that approach that we adopted on our build. We could have done it either way. I have heard people say the only reason people do timber frame straw bale builds is because they either don't understand the capabilities of the straw or because they like the aesthetics of the timber frame. And I would say 3 years ago, both of those reasons applied in parts to us.
Right.
So yes, we could have built this building as a load bearing building. But we really liked the idea of having a timber frame, a big chunky timber frame. We've used roundwood larch, and the frame sits inside the fabric of the building. So the corner of each room has a sort of 10, 12 inch roundwood post in the corner of it that supports the structure.
They exert a fair amount of dominance into the room. It's a very beautiful thing, and they're round, so they're like the trees already were, the branching off them, the braces, makes them more tree like again. So it's very much like you've sort of brought the forest inside. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Hey there, I'm Mick from the Mick and Pat Show.
That's right, and I'm Pat.
Looking for a podcast that's like catching up with old friends? Well, you're in luck.
We're here to bring you weekly doses of lifestyle commentary, discuss culture and politics, and top it off with the occasional beer and film reviews.
But it's not just about us. We're a community. Our listeners are our kin, and we let you all have a say in what we discuss.
So saddle up and join the conversation at the Mick and Pat Show. You can check out our website or find us wherever you get your podcasts.
We found a really nice company, T-Pren. They're based in Lampeter, in Wales. Not very far from here, less than an hour's drive from here. And they're traditional timber framers. It's all round wood. It's oak pegs. There are no power tools involved in the construction of the frame. The frame was made in the woods. So the framers were able to walk out into the woods. They were able to select the trees they wanted, fell them, and literally drag them 100 yards back to the workshop, where all the jointing was done over the winter. Mm-hmm. And the frame arrived on site basically sort of flat pack, if you like.
Yeah.
One day unloading it all. And the timber frame went up in February 2017 here on site. Took about 10 days or so.
Right.
Five people.
Did you use cranes and things for that, or was that?
No, it was all done by hand.
Fantastic.
Block and tackle, gin pole.
Yeah.
No power tools used at all in the construction, the erection. So it was all, even big timbers I think the longest timbers here are about 8 meters long. And as I say, 12, 14 inches at the thickest.
Yeah.
And these were green
as well.
And so. Greens are heavy and lifted up with winches and very,
fantastic.
Very conventional, the same way a building would have been built literally 1,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So 1,000 years ago in the UK, we were building, mortise and tenons with oak pegs in the same way that this house was built. And there's no metal in the frame at all until it came to, affixing joists and rafters. So when you start dealing with the square cut timbers, you started using nails. And over the last 2 years or so, as the greenwood has dried out a bit, the joints have sort of tightened up. So the wood is green and will shrink, but the pegs are pre-season, so won't shrink. So the wood tightens around the joints. And leaves a really nice structure, but it also has a degree of flex in it. And when you're using the natural materials, it's quite nice not to have super hard, rigid materials, because when you have rigid materials meeting, you can kind of maybe get cracks, and there's always going to be a little bit of movement in a building.
Mm.
And it's nice if the materials, the clay and the lime and the straw and the timber, the whole thing just has a little bit of malleability to it, a little bit of flex to it. So we haven't really had any of the issues in the first year or so of things moving and causing problems.
Yeah.
There hasn't been really any, hasn't been really any snagging to do at all, really.
Fantastic. Has the drying of the timbers, have you had any loud cracks? And
yeah, we have actually. We only notice it at night, and sometimes you're lying in bed at night, it's totally dark, and you hear this sort of, often a sort of tick, 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 and then a loud crack.
Yeah.
As the round wood shrinks a bit and cracks a bit.
Yeah.
But no, it's structurally, there's no issue in that at all. They do say that for a given cross section or area, a round wood timber is quite a lot stronger than a square cut timber.
Yeah.
Because all the fibers are still in place. You're not cutting through the fibers. You're not weakening it. So, from a structural engineering point of view, our structural engineer had no issue with the design at all. He did all the load calculations for our foundation, and basically the roundwood timber frame is significantly over-engineered than what would be required to hold a building of this size up.
So, as you say, you said at the beginning, these timbers could be, if this house for some reason comes down, they could be reused, like when you see old ship's timbers being used to sort of hold up a barn or something.
Absolutely. We would expect a lot of the fabric of this building to actually outlive the building itself.
Right.
I mean, it's possible this building will stand for hundreds of years, but if it didn't, the timbers haven't been used up in the same way that cement is used up when it goes into a building. You don't recover the cement from a cement building, but a lot of these materials could be recovered. These timbers will have a life, or have a good chance of having a lifespan beyond this building, keeping the sort of the 1970s and 1980s carbon that's inside them out of the atmosphere for potentially hundreds of years.
So hopefully we've sorted out all that carbon issue.
maybe.
You touched briefly on foundations there. I'm interested to know what you used here. I mean, obviously the convention in sort of modern building is to dig a big trench and fill it with concrete. I'm assuming that's not what you've done.
Yeah, so the foundations are quite a light touch. The ground here is very solid. We're on quite stony ground. So it's a case of removing all the topsoil, obviously, and removing the the subsoil. We didn't have to go down very deep before we got down to something that was really quite solid.
So
we did dig trenches. I think there's 7 trenches that run across the site, and they are filled with 40 mil clean gravel.
Just to allow the draining.
And then there's the contact points where the timber frame meets the ground. Mm-hmm. All the weight of the house is just taken on a relatively small number of these contact points,
right,
where the timber frame meets the ground, and the ground floor is suspended above ground on the timber frame. So each of those contact points has a large concrete padstone.
Right.
So we actually use car tires. They're not traditional car tire foundations as is often used in straw bale buildings. We've just used the car tire as a convenient shuttering for cement.
Okay.
So we have these cast cement pads, which are the size of fairly large car tires, sort of SUV 4x4 type car tires.
Yeah.
Which give us a nice round solid concrete padstone,
okay,
onto which the timber frame sits with a damp proof membrane,
yeah,
as a in addition. And
so it's real minimal amount of
concrete. Yeah, I think we've used about 500 kilos of cement, so half a ton or so,
yeah,
of cement for what is a fairly significant building.
Yeah,
so that's well less, like well over an order of magnitude less than would be used in a concrete pad or even a concrete ring beam. So we're really pleased to have been able to keep our cement use as minimal as that.
Mm.
It would have been nice to use no cement at all, but there is this sort of phrase of don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. We think that we've made sort of 90% plus reductions.
Yeah.
And it would have been a bit more challenging to get rid of the very last bit. So yeah, in a perfect world, we wouldn't have used cement at all, but we've used dramatically less than a conventional build.
Yeah.
So we're kind of happy with that. Whenever you try and do something, there's always compromises. And
it really is.
That was a compromise.
Yes. Well, I mean, it should be that the rest of the build should negate the cement. Mm.
So moving on from the timber frame, with the timber frame up, you can build the roof first.
Yeah.
So we had a period of time in the summer when we had the floor, and we had the timber frame, and we had the roof.
Right.
And at that point, you hope there isn't going to be a really serious wind.
Yeah, you've created a mighty sail.
We have, yes. But having the roof built before the walls means that the 500 straw bales can be delivered to site.
Right.
And delivered to the house. So we didn't have to worry about having a barn for the straw bales. We didn't have to worry about having tarpaulins and keeping them dry.
Yeah.
The straw bales could come straight from the tractor into the house. And then we built the walls from the inside out.
Right.
And having the roof there already makes it a lot easier to keep the walls dry as you're building them.
Yeah.
You've already got the roof, and we had scaffolding around, so we were able to have scaffolding sheeting around. In hindsight, it would have been even easier if we'd already put the guttering on, but we hadn't put the guttering on. So yeah, pro tip is if you're going to build the roof first, doing a timber frame straw bale build, it's worth putting the guttering on. That makes water management that much easier.
We haven't discussed that this build, you are a true self-builder in the sense that you've done every part of it, well, except the frame, but
we've done the majority of the work ourselves. So the timber frame was built by a local workers cooperative, also included 2 apprentices. So 2 apprentices worked on building the frame off site and in the erection of it here. So that was nice. So you could say we took on the site with the frame already in situ. So then we did the straw bale walls with the help of volunteers.
Yep.
We did the lime rendering on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
That also included a lime rendering course from Barbara Jones of School of Natural Building. So she hosted a 5-day course here where we learnt how to do lime rendering.
Mm-hmm.
And also had a few extra hands to help that week. And then the rest of the lime rendering and the clay plastering on the inside, that took a long time, many months of work. And we had a lot of volunteers to help with the lime rendering and the clay plastering. So the only parts of the build that we've paid external professionals to help with is the timber frame. The electrics.
Right.
With a qualified electrician. We had some help putting the steel roof on.
Right.
We could have done it ourselves. We used a product from Tata Steel called Color Coat Urban, which is relatively easy to install. It is possible for non-roofing professionals to install it.
Yeah.
But it just got a little bit late in the year, and we sort of ran out of time and energy ourselves to do it. So we paid a local experienced roofing company who did it in 3 days, and it just sort of made that issue disappear, which is always nice. Yeah. So I was saying, timber frame, electrician, a roofer. We also employed a plumber to do much of the plumbing. And that's basically it, I think. A stove fitter to do the to do the flue,
a heat ass.
A heat ass qualified engineer to do that. So that's sort of our limit of professional services. Yeah. So all the other aspects of the build have basically been done by ourselves with volunteers and friends and family helping as well.
And so, including project management and all of that, that's been all your.
Oh yeah, so project management was certainly ourselves.
Big task in itself.
Yeah, and it's taken about 2 years or so to be complete enough to finish to live in. I mean, it's not absolutely finished. There are a few rough edges here or there. Mm-hmm. We'll see how long it takes to if it will ever be what you would call finished. But as we're recording this at the end of March, and our focus is starting to be outside now, and we're looking more at developing the gardens and are growing this year, and expecting the chicks to arrive soon. And it's all just sort of as spring turns into summer, it's sort of building slides down the agenda, perhaps.
Yep. But I mean, it's certainly, it's very comfortable. It's, I think all of your walls, most of your walls have got plaster on them, and it's certainly a livable space. I've seen people live in much less completed.
We're very pleased with the performance of the building in terms of its heat, especially. We're off grid, so all our electricity comes from our solar panels. We also have a wood stove with a oven and a back boiler for heating water. Photovoltaics, PV electric panels, do generate a lot of our hot water. Mm-hmm. In March this year, 2019, we've only lit the wood stove 3 times.
Fantastic.
And for hot water, not really for space heating. So we've lit it for hot water. But other than those 3 times, all our hot water has come from the solar electric.
Yeah.
Being off grid, we can't export the electric. So any solar electric that we generate, which isn't used in that instant as it's being generated, we put into the hot water tank. So we have immersion heaters that keep the hot water tank up. So the hot water is continually being dumped modest amounts of electrical energy. And unless it's really cloudy for many days in a row, that's actually enough for all our hot water requirements. And last summer, it was only sort of middle of November that we started lighting the wood stove for both space heating and hot water. So all but sort of three and a half months, are living on solar PV for our hot water, our electricity. All our cooking is electric oven, electric kettle, electric induction hobs. PV does work even here in Southwest Wales.
I saw a post of yours which was talking about the how dark it was it November, December?
So this winter gone was our first winter living here off-grid, relying on our solar panels. And December was very dark. I hadn't realized it at the time, but looking back at the climate data a few months later, here in Southwest Wales, we only had about 30% of the normal amount of sunshine for December.
Wow.
So it was really dark.
Yeah.
And because it was our first year living here, we weren't entirely sure, is this normal or is this not? Because, yeah, it's quite dark here. We're struggling a bit on the power. But looking at the data has actually made us feel a lot better about the situation. Because it turns out that December 18 was a particularly dark dark month. There was very stable high pressure, very low cloud. It wasn't a particularly wet month, but because there was this very low cloud base, it was just dark for a lot of the time. And that cloudy, dark weather corresponded with a time when obviously the days were at their shortest.
Yes.
Now, had that same weather pattern occurred at a time of year when the days weren't so short, it wouldn't have had such an impact. But it was a sort of perfect storm of the very shortest days with the very worst weather conditions persisting for several weeks. People in this part of the country that rely a lot on solar panels were struggling a bit this winter. But this wasn't typical. It's very likely that next winter will be a lot better than the winter just gone.
And do you have a backup source of power? Do you have a generator or water?
We don't have any backup source of electricity. I specifically designed the PV system, the solar electric system, not to even be able to accept a generator input, because we really didn't even want the temptation of being able to use a generator. So we couldn't plug a generator in even if we wanted to. Because the system really should be able to cope without that. But living off-grid on solar panels is perfectly viable, is perfectly possible, as long as you manage your expectations, as long as you have what I call a behavioural change backstop, if you like. So 9 times out of 10, we can live in this house perfectly normally.
Yeah.
We run perfectly conventionally for the UK.
Yeah.
We have a normal washing machine. We have a normal electric oven. We have a normal toaster and electric hobs and IT and lighting, as you'd expect in a conventional house in the UK. And 9 times out of 10, we can use them without really thinking about it. But if we were to design a system so you could use all that infrastructure on every single day under every single circumstance, that would be virtually impossible.
Right.
Or it would be incredibly expensive, take up a lot of area. It would be really, really difficult. But if you're willing to say, okay, sometimes for a couple of weeks a year, a few weeks a year, we're not going to do that. We're not going to cook on electric. We're not going to run the washing machine more than once a week. As long as you're able to modify your behavior a bit, just pull back on your demand a bit, that's what makes the reliance on renewables viable. And we've learned that from our own personal domestic experience. But I think that lesson probably also applies on a national level as well. So the UK can generate a lot of electricity from renewables, but don't expect renewables to cover absolutely everything all the time and maintain the current behavior mix that we have. But that doesn't mean to say they're not useful. It doesn't mean to say they can't make a big contribution. Just don't expect them to be everything, because then you're into a system design which is just hopelessly uneconomical. Hopelessly over-engineered almost all the time.
Right.
If you're trying to
cater
for the worst case scenario, that means you've over-provisioned all the rest of the time. So it's kind of getting that balance point right.
Yeah.
And so I should say our solar array is 6.4 kilowatts.
Okay.
And on a good day in the summer, we can be getting 30 or 40 kilowatt hours out of that. The majority goes into hot water, which means you've got a vast supply of hot water. On our very, very worst days, in the middle of winter, we were getting about 0.3, 0.4 kilowatt hours in a day. And that's not very much.
No.
0.3, 0.4 kilowatt hours is the equivalent of a few minutes of bright sunshine.
Right.
But that's what we were getting in over the whole day. And that is barely enough to keep the lights on and keep a fridge running, maybe the internet router. But that's basically what we were down to for a couple of weeks last winter.
Okay.
But that was okay. And the infrastructure it would have required to live without any restrictions for those couple of weeks would have just been incredible. It would have resulted in a massive expense and a massive over-engineering of the system for all the rest of the year.
Yeah.
So yeah, we can modify our behavior for those worst, lowest output weeks.
Or you end up quite a lot of people I've met in the States who are like, yeah, I live off grid. I'm totally self-sustainable. And then they totally self-sustained rather. And then, well, yeah, I run my generator 3 times a week.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of defeats the point in a way, doesn't it? If you're having to run a generator, but it's the end of the day. So it's like, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. If you have to run a generator 3 times a year and that mitigates a whole lot of other stuff, then yeah, that's not the end of the world. I mean, our system is such that we don't need to run a generator for the demands, for the loads that we place on it. But yeah, if you have to burn 10 litres of petrol a year to keep the lights on, that's, put that into context of how much petrol you're putting in a car, perhaps.
Yeah.
Then 10 litres of petrol to run a generator 3 times a year is pretty trivial compared to the car you're maybe driving every other day. So yes, if you're, the environment, the climate doesn't care if the petrol is burnt in a car or burnt in a generator.
Mm-hmm. So you gave us a tour of your battery system and your charge controllers, and it was like looking at something from a spaceship. It was quite a beautiful sight. I could tell that you were very pleased with it as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's been built for redundancy. The way the solar panels are arranged on the roof, there's 2 separate arrays with 2 separate cables coming in. We have 2 separate charge controllers. So if anything happens to the array, or if anything happens to the cable, if anything happens to the electronics in the charge controller, there's a degree of redundancy there. On the demand side, the lighting is all 24 volt DC lighting for the house. So it doesn't require the electrics of inversion. So it doesn't require an inverter. And on the AC side, we have a relatively low power inverter, which is on 24/7 and runs all the things that you need to have on all the time. Smoke alarms, internet router, the freezer, relatively low load, but needs to be there 24/7. And then we've got another inverter, which is a bigger inverter, 6 kilowatt inverter, which we only turn on when we actually need it to run power tools or to run the electric oven.
The big stuff.
Yeah. Because if you leave a big inverter on 24/7 just to run your internet router, that's very inefficient, because the big inverter actually has quite a big load even when nothing is on.
So
we split the AC supply into this little inverter that's on all the time and a big inverter that we manually switch on whenever we want to use an appliance with a high requirement.
And that's that change in habit again, that, you know.
We've learned to live with the system. It's the new normal.
It's not a huge change to flick on one switch before you flick on another.
It's very straightforward. And the other sort of aspect of behavior change is interesting, because we do attempt to use the power when it's available, when it's being generated. There is an inefficiency of putting it into the batteries and taking it out again.
Right.
And the batteries also have a finite life. And the harder you work the batteries, the shorter period of time they'll live for. So we do try to have our main meal, our cooked meal at lunchtime and a lighter dinner. So we're not cooking on the electric oven after dark. We don't always manage it. But it tends to be the case that suns comes out. That's when we do something that has a high.
So your washing happens.
We put the washing machine on when the sun comes out.
Yeah.
We don't do the washing machine in the evening.
Yeah.
So it's just little changes. But the fact that we live on site and I don't have to commute off site every day, 9 to 5 to a job, makes that sort of lifestyle more viable.
Yeah.
We are able to make micro decisions minute by minute, hour by hour, based on what the environment's doing.
Yeah.
Rather than having to walk out the door 8 o'clock every morning and not coming back until 6 o'clock after dark. Which means you'd be unable to make use of that solar resource.
Yeah. And I suppose that's the purpose of the One Planet, isn't it? The One Planet development is that it's, you know, you're creating not just a way to get a house. It's a whole way of living that's, you know, enables that.
Yeah, that absolutely. What the One Planet development planning policy is absolutely not just about building a house. It's about the behavior of the occupants, and it's about facilitating the environment that lets people live in a different way. Mm-hmm. So the fact that we are able to live on a site with a significant amount of land, which we have to run this land-based enterprise from. So yeah. Basically my job is working on this site. Means that we're not commuting off-site, means that our transport costs and the impact of our transport are significantly lower than they would be otherwise. We're able to respond to the site in a way that we couldn't do if we lived a long way away, or if we had to leave site for a significant amount of time every day.
Yeah.
So it makes the management and the operation of the site more efficient than just the fact that we're able to be here all the time, and it's really good for the kids. We've got two young children, and it's really nice for them to have this safe environment to grow up in, and that we're here all the time for them.
So I wanted to ask you about the One Planet Council. That's something you set up, is that right?
So the One Planet Council was formed quite a few years ago. Mm-hmm. It's a voluntary group. And our main aim is to promote and support the policy. Mm-hmm. We offer support and training to applicants who are looking to use the policy. We also offer training to planning officials,
right.
And councillors who are on the other side, on receiving and evaluating
right.
these applications. We also offer a space for the OPD practitioners to share best practice.
Okay.
And a sort of community group.
Yeah.
There's a Facebook group, a web page, a Twitter account, which are all quite actively used. In the summer, in July mm-hmm. last year, and we will be doing it again this year, we run a sort of open doors week
okay.
where a dozen or more One Planet developments open their doors to the public for a day during this sort of managed week.
Yeah.
So that everyone can see just what's involved in a One Planet development.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And that is coming up this summer.
When is that?
I think it is the week commencing July 22nd.
Okay.
That's a Monday.
I'll check that and put it on the blog. Which goes with this.
Otherwise, look at the One Planet Council website.
Okay.
You just search One Planet Council or the One Planet Council Facebook group.
Mm-hmm.
The best places to look. But yeah, there's a few different things we do. The training, the open days. We also have a One Planet Produce sticker. Because a fundamental aspect of a One Planet development is that it produces produce for sale, which is grown or reared on site. But how do you market that? So we have a logo, One Planet Produce logo, which is available for all One Planet developments to use.
Yeah.
So it shows their customers that the jar of honey or the salad bag or the box of eggs that they're purchasing was produced on a One Planet development, which tells you about the environmental impact. It tells you about the lifestyle, the ethos. It tells you a little bit about the provenance
mm-hmm.
of that food. It's not dissimilar in sort of motivation for the sort of Soil Association's organic logo or the Fair Trade logo.
Yeah.
It just communicates with your customer base a bit more about the product. So it doesn't say anything more than the produce is from a One Planet development.
Yeah. Well, Chris, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been fascinating to talk to you.
Oh, thank you, Jeffrey. It's really, really good to talk to you today. And let's go and have some lunch.
Yes, perfect. Thank you. Thank you so much to Chris for sparing the time to speak to me. He is a wealth of knowledge and really great that he is out there doing it. His home is really spectacular. I do recommend you check out TPREN, which is spelt T-Y-P-R-E-N. They are the Roundwood Timber Framers. Thank you once again to Mike Bite Hill for the wonderful theme music. And thank you to yourself for listening right to the end like a champion. If you are enjoying these podcasts, please do subscribe and we will continue to feed them into your ears. That's all for me. See you soon. Bye-bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This Mother's Day, treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their advanced eye care duo brightens and firms skin around your eyes, while the Golden Glow Body Trio nourishes and smooths skin all over. Go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM for 10% off your first order site-wide.